density by about 50%.
The scientists are telling us that what the science tells them is that unless we act quickly and dramatically, this is indeed, in Churchill's phrase, only the first sip of a bitter cup which will be proffered to us year by year until there is a supreme recovery of moral health. We also have to connect the dots. When the Superfund sites aren't cleaned up, we get a toxic gumbo and a flood. When there is not adequate public transportation for the poor, it is difficult to evacuate a city. When there is no ability to give medical care to poor people, it is difficult to get hospitals to take refugees in the middle of a crisis. When the wetlands are turned over to the developers, the storm surges from the ocean threaten the coastal cities more. When there is no effort to restrain the global warming pollution gases, then global warming gets worse, with all of the consequences that the scientific community has warned us about. Abraham Lincoln once said, "The occasion is piled high with difficulty, and we must rise with the occasion. As our case is new, we must think anew and act anew. We must disenthrall ourselves, and then we shall save our country." And so must we disenthrall ourselves from the sound and light show that has diverted the attentions of our great democracy from the important issues and challenges of our day. We must disenthrall ourselves from the Michael Jackson trial and the Aruba search and the latest sequential obsession with celebrity trials or whatever relative triviality dominates the conversation of democracy instead of making room for us as free American citizens to talk with one another about our true situation and then save our country. The refugees we have seen in our own country could well be the first sip of that bitter cup, because sea level rise in countries around the world will create millions of environmental refugees. This is a moral moment. This is not ultimately about any scientific debate or political dialogue. Ultimately, it is about who we are as human beings, and whether or not we have the capacity to transcend our own limitations and rise to this new occasion. It is about whether or not we can see with our hearts as well as our heads the unprecedented response that is now called for, whether or not we can, in Lincoln's phrase, disenthrall ourselves, shed the illusions that have been our accomplices in ignoring the warnings that have been clearly given, and to hear, clearly, the ones that are being given now. At another moment of supreme challenge, Lincoln told us that the question ultimately facing the people of the United States of America was whether or not this government, of the people, by the people, and for the people, conceived in liberty and dedicated to freedom, or any government so conceived, would perish from this earth. Where there is no vision, the people perish. But there is another side to this moral challenge. Where there is vision, the people prosper and flourish, and the natural world recovers, and our communities recover. The good news is we know what to do. The good news is we have everything we need now to respond to the challenge of global warming. We have all the technologies we need, though more and better ones are being developed, and as they become available and become more affordable when produced in scale, they will make it easier to respond. We have everything we need, save, perhaps, political will. And in our democracy, political will is a renewable resource. We are now at a true fork in the road. And in order to take the right path, we must choose the right values and adopt the right perspective. This is the time for those who see and understand and care and are willing to work to say, this time the warnings will not be ignored. This time we will prepare. This time we will rise to the occasion and we will prevail. This is not a political issue. This is a moral issue. It affects the survival of human civilization. It is not a question of left versus right. It is a question of right versus wrong. Put simply, it is wrong to destroy the habitability of our planet and ruin the prospects of every generation that follows ours. What is motivating millions of Americans to think differently about the climate crisis is the growing realization that this challenge is bringing us unprecedented opportunity. I have spoken before about the way the Chinese express the concept of crisis. They use two symbols, the first of which, by itself, means danger. The second, in isolation, means opportunity. Put them together and you get crisis. Our single word conveys the danger, but doesn't always communicate the presence of opportunity in every crisis. In this case, the opportunity presented by the climate crisis is not only the opportunity for new and better jobs, new technologies, new opportunities for profit, and a higher quality of life. It gives us an opportunity to experience something that few generations ever have the privilege of knowing. A common moral purpose, compelling enough to lift us above our limitations and motivate us to set aside some of the bickering to which we as human beings are naturally vulnerable. America's so-called greatest generation found such a purpose when they confronted the crisis of global fascism and won a war in Europe and in the Pacific simultaneously. In the process of achieving their historic victory, they found that they had gained new moral authority and a new capacity for vision. They created the Marshall Plan and lifted their recently defeated adversaries from their knees and assisted them to a future of dignity and self-determination. They created the United Nations and the other global institutions that made possible many decades of prosperity, progress, and relative peace. In recent years, we have squandered that moral authority, and it is high time to renew it by taking on the highest challenge of our generation. In rising to meet this challenge, we too will find self-renewal and transcendence, and a new capacity for vision to see other crises in our time that cry out for solutions. 20 million HIV/AIDS orphans in Africa alone, civil wars fought by children, genocides and famines, the rape and pillage of our oceans and forests, an extinction crisis that threatens the web of life, and tens of millions of our fellow humans dying every year from easily preventable diseases. And by rising to meet the climate crisis, we will find the vision and moral authority to see all these not as political problems, but as moral imperatives. It is therefore an opportunity for bipartisanship and transcendence, an opportunity to find our better selves and create a brighter future. Chapter 8, Democracy in the Balance. The relationship between checks and balances on the one hand and the reliance on the rule of reason on the other is the Da Vinci Code of American democracy. The astonishing sophistication of our founders' understanding of human nature included a penetrating insight into the vulnerability we all have to make reason itself a slave to ego. Though this Freudian concept obviously did not exist 2 centuries ago, our founders understood it nevertheless. In Federalist No. 10, Madison wrote, "As long as the reason of man continues fallible and he is at liberty to exercise it, different opinions will be formed. As long as the connection subsists between his reason and his self-love, his opinions and his passions will have a reciprocal influence on each other, and the former will be objects to which the latter will attach themselves." In other words, reason must be separated from the self-love of the individuals using it and focused instead on the public good by ensuring that no individual or small group can exercise power without entering into a negotiation with others who must be convinced that the proposed exercise of power meets the test of reason. As much as our founders relied on a well-informed citizenry to exercise the rule of reason and free expression to safeguard American democracy, they believed that reason alone was not enough to ensure the survival of the republic. James Madison argued in Federalist No. 51, "A dependence on the people is no doubt the primary control on the government, but experience has taught mankind the necessity of auxiliary precautions." The auxiliary precautions he had in mind were the checks and balances that our founders used in their design of the Constitution in order to prevent the unhealthy concentration of too much power in the hands of a few, and thereby to force those in authority to justify their views to one another by applying the rule of reason. When those in power are forced into a process of deliberation, then and only then will reason play its necessary central role. The separation of powers and the system of checks and balances are therefore essential to create the virtual space within which reason operates in American democracy. That is why, for more than two centuries, America's freedoms have been protected against the unhealthy accumulation of too much power in the hands of one person by our founders' wise decision to divide the aggregate power of our federal government into three co-equal branches, each of which serves to check and balance the power of the other two. But many of our founders continued to worry about one particular scenario that they felt would remain especially dangerous. In wartime, the president would enjoy a politically enhanced position in his role as commander-in-chief. During their debates in Philadelphia, they identified the potential accumulation of power in the hands of the executive as a serious threat to the republic. They worried that the president's suddenly increased political power during times of war might spill over its normal constitutional boundary and upset the delicate checks and balances so crucial to the maintenance of liberty. That is precisely why they took extra care to parse the war powers in the Constitution, assigning the command of the troops to the president, but retaining for the Congress not only the crucial power of deciding whether or not and when our nation might decide to go to war, but also significant powers to define the nature and scope of the mission. These powers include the power to raise and support armies and navies, and the power to make rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces, among numerous others. These limitations on the power of the executive to make war were seen as crucially important. James Madison wrote in a letter to Thomas Jefferson these words, "The Constitution supposes what the history of all governments demonstrates, that the executive is the branch of power most interested in war and most prone to it. It has accordingly, with studied care, vested the question of war in the legislature." During the Korean War, one of our most eloquent Supreme Court justices, Robert Jackson, wrote that the president should be given the widest latitude in wartime. But he warned against the loose and irresponsible invocation of war as an excuse for discharging the executive branch from the rules of law that govern our republic in times of peace. Jackson continued, "No penance would ever expiate the sin against free government of holding that a president can escape control of executive powers by law through assuming his military role. Our government has ample authority under the Constitution to take those steps which are genuinely necessary for our security. At the same time, our system demands that the government act only on the basis of measures that have been the subject of open and thoughtful debate in Congress and among the American people, and that invasions of the liberty or equal dignity of any individual are subject to review by courts which are open to those affected and independent of the government which is curtailing their freedom." In more recent decades, of course, the emergence of new modern weapons that virtually eliminate the period of time between the decision to go to war or the declaration of war and the actual waging of war has naturally led to a reconsideration of the exact nature of the executive's war-making power. During the most dangerous decades of the nuclear standoff with the former Soviet Union, Americans had to adapt to the possibility that a devastating act of war against our nation might be commenced with as little as 15 minutes warning. Naturally, practical adjustments were made in our thinking that included the assumption that the president would use his inherent powers as commander-in-chief to respond immediately by waging all-out war. Uniformed military officers began following the president wherever he went with a mobile command apparatus, what became known as the nuclear football. Inevitably, the nation's awareness of the president's commander-in-chief persona played a more prominent role in its perceptions of him. The more recent fear that terrorist groups may acquire a nuclear weapon has further enhanced the pragmatic imperatives many feel should increase the discretion allowed to the president to take unilateral action to protect the nation without waiting for Congress to play a role. But the practicalities of modern nuclear warfare and counterterrorism, both of which do necessarily lead to increased war powers for the president at the expense of Congress, do not thereby render moot the concerns our founders had so long ago that the making of war by the president, when added to his other powers, carries with it the potential for unbalancing the careful design of our Constitution and, in the process, threatening our liberties. When President Bush was forced to accept Congress's compromise authorization use of military force, which did not give him the full power he had sought, he secretly assumed it anyway, as if congressional authorization were a useless bother. But as Justice Felix Frankfurter once wrote, "To find authority so explicitly withheld is not merely to disregard in a particular instance the clear will of Congress. It is to disrespect the whole legislative process and the constitutional division of authority between President and Congress." I am convinced that our founders would counsel us today that one of the greatest challenges facing our republic, in addition to terrorism, as serious as that threat is how we react to terrorism and how we manage our fears and achieve security without losing our freedom. I am also convinced that they would warn us that democracy itself is in grave danger if we allow any president to use his role as commander-in-chief to rupture the careful balance between the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of government. Our founders were greatly influenced, far more than we can imagine, by a careful reading of the history and human drama surrounding the democracies of ancient Greece and the Roman Republic. They knew, for example, that democracy disappeared in Rome when Caesar crossed the Rubicon in violation of the Roman Senate's long prohibition against a returning general entering the city while still in command of military forces. Though the Senate lingered in form and was humored for decades, when Caesar impolitically combined his military commander role with his chief of state role, the Roman Senate, and with it the Roman Republic and the dream of democracy, withered away. And for all intents and purposes, democracy disappeared from the face of the earth for 17 centuries until its rebirth in our land. Our current president has gone to war and has symbolically marched back into the city, wearing his commander-in-chief persona, and has declared that our nation is, until further notice, in a permanent state of war, which will likely last for the rest of our lives. He implies this permanent state of war justifies his unilateral reinterpretation of the Constitution in ways that increase his power as president at the expense of Congress, the courts, and every individual citizen. Indeed, he has even partially militarized domestic law enforcement by ordering uniformed military personnel to commence surveillance within the country on American citizens, businesses, and civic organizations that, in the view of the military, might pose some threat to our nation. In times past, this was unthinkable, but it has been met with very little protest. In other words, President Bush has determinedly conflated his role of commander-in-chief with his roles of head of government and head of state. And in doing so, he has maximized the power he has been given by Americans who are fearful of being attacked and are eager to receive his promises of protection. "We must surrender some of our traditional American freedoms," he tells us, "so that he may have sufficient power to protect us against those who would do us harm." And indeed, public fear of an attack remains at unusually high levels almost 6 years after we were viciously attacked on September 11, 2001. Of course, we have been constantly reminded of that attack in almost every speech by the president since it occurred, and we have been told that it is the justification for almost everything he has done. Even though we are now attuned to elevated orange alerts and the potential for terrorist attacks, our founders would almost certainly caution us that the biggest threat to the future of the America we love is still the endemic challenge that democracies have always faced whenever they have appeared in history, a challenge rooted in the inherent difficulty of self-governance and the vulnerability to fear that is part of human nature. Indeed, We have already witnessed some serious erosion of the checks and balances that have always maintained a healthy democracy in America. President Bush is not the first president to press the boundaries of these new possibilities for exercising enhanced executive power. When the Soviet nuclear threat had freshly emerged, President Truman pushed the limits of his power during the Korean War by seizing control of several steel mills, as mentioned in Chapter 5. In the case that struck down Truman's seizure, Justice Robert Jackson eloquently restated the concerns about too much power concentrated in the executive branch that our founders had understood by reference to King George III, and Jackson updated their insights by reference to the new 20th century guise of strongman rule embodied in both Hitler, who had just been defeated, and Stalin, who was even then posing a deadly threat. The example of such unlimited executive power that must have most impressed the forefathers was the prerogative exercised by George III, and the description of its evils in the Declaration of Independence leads me to doubt that they created their new executive in his image. And if we seek instruction from our own times, he continued, we can match it only from the executive governments we disparagingly describe as totalitarian. Respect for our president is important, but even more important is respect for our Constitution. In that regard, it is crucial to emphasize that our ingrained American distrust of concentrated power has very little to do with the character or persona of the individual who wields that power. It is the power itself that must be constrained, checked, dispersed, and carefully balanced to ensure the survival of freedom. The limitations on the reach of executive power that are spelled out in the Constitution almost always take more specific form as laws enacted by Congress that presidents bent on expanding their power are tempted to ignore or violate. A president who breaks the law is a threat to the very structure of our government. Our founding fathers were adamant that they had established a government of laws and not men. Indeed, they recognized that the structure of government they had enshrined in our Constitution, our system of checks and balances, was designed with a central purpose of ensuring that it would govern through the rule of law. As John Adams said, "The executive shall never exercise the legislative and judicial powers, or either of them, to the end that it may be a government of laws and not of men." Our founders were keenly aware that the history of the world proves that republics are fragile. In the very hour of America's birth in Philadelphia, Benjamin Franklin was asked, "Well, doctor, what have we got, a republic or a monarchy?" He replied cautiously, "A republic, if you can keep it." The survival of freedom depends upon the rule of law. The rule of law depends in turn upon the respect each generation of Americans has for the integrity with which our laws are written, interpreted, and enforced. President Bush has repeatedly violated the law for 6 years. In spite of the fact that the only judicial decision to have reached the question of legality has ruled comprehensively against the president's massive and warrantless surveillance program, both the Justice Department and the Congress have failed to take any action to enforce the law. There has been no request for a special prosecutor, and there has been no investigation by the FBI. There has been deafening silence. But the consequences to our democracy of silently ignoring serious and repeated violations of the law by the President of the United States are extremely serious. Once violated, the rule of law is in danger. Unless stopped, lawlessness grows. The greater the power of the executive grows, the more difficult it becomes for the other branches to perform their constitutional roles. As the executive acts outside its constitutionally prescribed role and is able to control access to information that would expose its actions, it becomes increasingly difficult for the other branches to police it. Once that ability is lost, democracy itself is threatened, and we become a government of men and not laws. An executive who arrogates to himself the power to ignore the legitimate legislative directives of the Congress or to act free of the check of the judiciary becomes the central threat that the founders sought to nullify in the Constitution. In the words of James Madison, the accumulation of all powers, legislative, executive, and judiciary, in the same hands, whether of one, a few, or many, and whether hereditary, self-appointed, or elective, may justly be pronounced the very definition of tyranny. What would Benjamin Franklin think of President Bush's assertion that he has the inherent power, even without a declaration of war by the Congress, to launch an invasion of any nation on earth at any time he chooses, for any reason he wishes, even if that nation poses no imminent threat to the United States? How long would it take James Madison to dispose of our current president's claim in Department of Justice legal opinions that he is largely above the rule of law so long as he is acting in his role as commander-in-chief? I think it is safe to say that our founders would be genuinely concerned about these recent developments in American democracy, and that they would feel that we, here, are now facing a clear and present danger with the potential to threaten the future of the American experiment. Shouldn't we be equally concerned, and shouldn't we ask ourselves how it is that we have come to this point? In the name of security, this administration has attempted to relegate the Congress and the courts to the sidelines and replace our democratic system of checks and balances with an unaccountable executive. And all the while, it has constantly angled for new ways to exploit the sense of crisis for partisan gain and political dominance. This effort to rework America's carefully balanced constitutional design into a lopsided structure dominated by an all-powerful executive branch with a subservient Congress and judiciary is an extremely dangerous threat to the survival of liberty. As a result of its unprecedented claim of new unilateral power, the executive branch has now put our constitutional design at grave risk. One of President Bush's most contemptuous and dangerous practices has been his chronic abuse of what are called signing statements. These are written pronouncements that the president issues upon signing a bill into law. Throughout our history, these statements have served a mainly ceremonial function, extolling the virtues of the legislation and thanking those figures responsible for the enactment. On occasion, these statements have also included passages in which the president raises constitutional concerns with some provisions of the new law. What presidents have always avoided is delineating those provisions that the president simply disagrees with and announcing that the president will not comply with them. Obviously, such a device would be unconstitutional on its face. The Constitution gives the president the choice of signing a law, vetoing a law, in which case the law does not go into effect unless a supermajority in both the House and the Senate override the veto, or refraining from signing a law, in which case it goes into effect without his signature after 10 days, unless the Congress goes out of session during those 10 days, in which case the law is negated by what is called a pocket veto. But those are the only options laid out in the Constitution. The president must either sign or veto each law that is presented to him by the Congress. The president is not a member of the legislative branch, and therefore is not entitled to pick apart all of the provisions of each law and decide for himself which provisions he will accept and which he will reject. Once the law has been passed by the Congress, he must either accept it or reject it in its entirety, as it is. As with some other abuses by the current administration, Bush is not the first president to attempt an expansion of executive authority, but his abuses are so far beyond those of any of his predecessors that they represent a difference of kind as well as degree. President Bill Clinton issued signing statements covering 140 laws over the 8 years of his presidency, as compared with his predecessor, George H.W. Bush, who objected to 232 laws during his 4 years in office. President George W. Bush, by contrast, has made this use of signing statements more than all of his predecessors combined, challenging the constitutionality of more than 1,000 laws during his first 6 years in office. The difference between the practice of President Clinton and President George W. Bush is not simply one of volume. Though that alone is striking, particularly given that President Clinton faced a hostile and adversarial Congress dominated by the opposing political party, while President Bush for the first 6 years faced a docile and supportive Congress. President Clinton's signing statements were based on well-settled principles of constitutional law and were guided by a desire to allow the judiciary to resolve issues of constitutional interpretation. President Bush's signing statements, however, rest on legal theories regarding his own power that are extreme and lacking in judicial support. In fact, his theory of his own power is so vast that in practice it amounts to an assertion of power that is so obviously unconstitutional, a power to simply declare what provisions of law he will and will not comply with. Many legal scholars have sounded alarms about this practice. One of them, law professor David Golub from New York University, says that Bush's assertions call into question the whole idea that there is a rule of law. Bruce Fein, who served as a deputy attorney general in the Reagan administration when Ed Meese and Samuel Alito began this practice, now says that it eliminates the checks and balances that keep the country a democracy. He added, "There is no way for an independent judiciary to check his assertions of power, and Congress isn't doing it either. So this is moving us toward an unlimited executive power." For example, after the administration dishonored and embarrassed the country by torturing large numbers of helpless prisoners, an overwhelming bipartisan majority passed legislation sponsored by three Republican senators, John McCain, John Warner, and Lindsey Graham, outlawing torture. Bush could have vetoed the law, but Congress almost certainly would have overridden his veto. Instead, he signed the law, but announced that he did not and would not have to abide by it. This helps to explain why Bush has vetoed only one bill during his entire term in office. Why bother if he can simply decide on his own whim which provisions of a law apply to him and which ones he will simply ignore? In numerous other cases, the president has bargained with the Congress to sway their votes in favor of a particular law by agreeing to support the inclusion of certain provisions that various members of the House and Senate insisted upon as a condition for their support. This practice, common in democracies, is known as compromise. In these cases, however, the president has turned around and announced in his signing statements that he would not enforce or accept as valid those portions of the law that had been put into the proposal by members of Congress as a condition of securing the support of a majority. To take another example, a bipartisan majority in Congress recently passed a law covering the U.S. Postal Service, as noted in Chapter 5, that explicitly reinforced the terms of the Fourth Amendment in the Bill of Rights and made it against the law for the president to open citizens' mail without a warrant. But the president issued a signing statement at the time he signed the law, emphasizing his own independent authority to order, without a warrant, that mail be opened for inspection. Should we amend all of the textbooks in America to explain to school children that what has been taught for more than two centuries about checks and balances is no longer valid? Should we teach them instead that the United States Congress and the courts are merely advisory groups that make suggestions to the president on what the law should be, but that the president is all-powerful and now has the final say on everything? Should we teach them that we are a government of men, not laws? Should we teach them that we used to be a democracy, but now we only pretend to be? The abusive use of signing statements to circumvent the founders' design of checks and balances is part of a broader effort by the administration to concentrate virtually all power in the hands of the executive branch. Indeed, the current administration came to power in the thrall of a legal theory that aims to convince us that this excessive concentration of presidential authority is exactly what our Constitution intended. This legal theory, which its proponents call the unitary executive, but is more accurately described as the unilateral executive, threatens to expand the president's powers until the contours of the Constitution that the founders actually gave us become obliterated beyond all recognition. Under this theory, the president's authority when acting as commander-in-chief or when making foreign policy, cannot be reviewed by the judiciary or checked by Congress. President Bush has pushed the implications of this idea to its maximum by continually stressing his role as commander-in-chief invoking it as frequently as he can and conflating it with his other roles, domestic and foreign. When added to the idea that we have entered a perpetual state of war, the implications of this theory stretch as far into the future as we can imagine. These claims must be rejected and a healthy balance of power restored to our republic. Otherwise, the fundamental nature of our democracy may well undergo a radical transformation. In yet another abuse justified by the unitary executive doctrine, the White House declared in early 2007 that all the rules and policy statements developed by government agencies will now undergo vetting and implementation by political appointees, providing another means through which political pressure can be brought to bear on the agencies that should be enforcing our health, safety, and environmental laws without political distortion. It is important to remember that in addition to the President's authority to faithfully execute the laws that is derived from Article 2 of the Constitution, he exercises other power that is specifically delegated to him by the Congress in statutory laws that often include numerous safeguards designed to ensure that laws and policies are enforced in a careful and fair manner. Often, these requirements are explicitly designed to prevent wealthy and powerful special interests from seizing control of the processes designed to protect the public from the abuses of those same special interests. In the current administration, the President's new initiative to bend all executive branch policymaking to the President's political agenda is part of the same power-seeking strategy. One disillusioned former official in the White House, John DeLeo, blew the whistle on this ubiquitous pattern when he left as advisor in charge of faith-based initiatives. DeLeo said, "What you've got is everything, and I mean everything, being run by the political arm. It's the reign of the Mayberry Machiavellis." Bush found intellectual underpinning for an aggressive presidency when in 1999, Karl Rove assigned the Texas governor a book called Energy in the Executive, The Case for the Strong Presidency by Terry Eastland. Based on Alexander Hamilton's assertion in the Federalist Papers that energy in the executive is a leading character in the definition of good government, Eastland's book, published in 1992, spelled out for conservatives an argument for a strong, unilateral presidency that they believed had been lost to post-Watergate reforms. One of the principal advocates of this bizarre unitary executive theory is the same Samuel Alito who was the first advocate of the abusive expansion of signing statements during the Reagan administration. Alito has been a longtime supporter of the so-called unitary executive and is not likely to serve as an effective check on the expansion of executive power. Likewise, Chief Justice Roberts has made plain his deference to the expansion of executive power through his support of judicial deference to executive agency rulemaking. Indeed, the President's judicial appointments, taken as a whole, are clearly designed to ensure that the courts will not serve as an effective check on executive power. The weakest and most vulnerable of the three branches, our founders generally agreed, was the judicial branch. The power of judging was seen, at least before Chief Justice John Marshall expanded the power of the Supreme Court in the early 1800s, as being nothing compared with the power of the purse or the sword. That inherent inequality of power, as Alexander Hamilton wrote in Federalist Paper No. 78, proves incontestably that the judiciary is beyond comparison the weakest of the three departments of power, that it can never attack with success either of the other two, and that all possible care is requisite to enable it to defend itself against their attacks. It is in continual jeopardy of being overpowered, awed, or influenced by its coordinate branches. Hamilton went on to caution, however, that if the power of the judiciary was ever combined with the power of either the executive or the legislative branch, then liberty itself would have everything to fear. For that reason, it was especially important to protect the independence of the judiciary, both from influence by the passions of a temporary majority in the legislative branch and from the inevitable hunger for consolidated power by the executive branch. Montesquieu, one of the most influential of the Enlightenment thinkers, often cited by our founders, wrote, "There is no liberty if the power of judging be not separated from the legislative and executive powers." In a properly functioning system, the judicial branch serves as the constitutional umpire to ensure that the branches of government observe their proper spheres of authority, observe civil liberties, and adhere to the rule of law. When James Madison introduced the Bill of Rights for consideration, he explained that the courts would be the guardians of our rights, an impenetrable bulwark against every assumption of power in the legislature or executive. Unfortunately, the current administration has tried hard to thwart the ability of the judiciary to call balls and strikes by keeping controversies out of its hands. For example, those challenges to the administration's ability to detain individuals without legal process. It has done so by appointing judges like Alito and Roberts, who are likely to be deferential to its exercise of power, and by its support of assaults on the independence of the third branch. President Bush is hardly the first president to seek control over the federal judiciary. Indeed, the struggle between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson was partly about whether the Federalists or the Anti-Federalists would control the majority of the judges. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt tried unsuccessfully to expand the size of the Supreme Court and pack it with justices who would support his New Deal agenda. Rarely in prior American history, however, has there been anything like the assault on the independence of the judiciary that we have seen during the Bush-Cheney years. Moreover, the administration has supported the assault on judicial independence that has been conducted by Republicans in Congress who have undertaken legislative efforts to curtail the jurisdiction of courts in matters ranging from habeas corpus to the Pledge of Allegiance. In short, the administration has demonstrated its contempt for the judicial role and sought to evade judicial review of its actions at every turn. A spokesman for James Sensenbrenner, former Republican chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, said, "There does seem to be this misunderstanding out there that our system was created with a completely independent judiciary." Misunderstanding? Some on the radical right have even engaged in outright threats and intimidations against federal judges with whose philosophy they disagreed, even after a judge was murdered in Atlanta while presiding in his courtroom. Even after the husband and mother of a federal judge were murdered in Chicago in retaliation by a disgruntled party to a failed lawsuit. Even after such acts, the Republican leader of the House of Representatives, Tom DeLay, could respond to rulings in the Terry Schiavo case by saying ominously, "The time will come for the men responsible for this to pay for their behavior." When the outrage following this comment worsened, Representative DeLay claimed that his words had been chosen badly, but in the very next breath he issued new threats against the same court when he said, "We seat the courts, we can unseat the courts. We have the power of the purse." Moreover, a host of prominent Republicans have been making similar threats on a regular basis. Republican Congressman Steve King from Iowa added, "If we pass a law, a specific law, and they reject that law, then the authority that they will begin to understand is when their budget starts to dry up, we'll get their attention. That's not my preferred method. My preferred method is to have them respect the Constitution and the law. But they are counterproductive to this country, and if we're going to preserve our Constitution, we must get them in line." United States Senator John Cornyn, a Republican from Texas, directly connected what he calls the state of courthouse violence to his view that unpopular decisions might be the explanation. "I wonder whether there may be some connection between the perception in some quarters on some occasions where judges are making political decisions yet are unaccountable to the public, that it builds up and builds up to the point where some people engage in violence, certainly without any justification, but that is a concern I have." What a disgraceful, inflammatory, and dangerous comment. Michael Schwartz, the chief of staff for Republican Senator Tom Coburn from Oklahoma, cried for mass impeachment by using the bizarre right-wing theory that the president can simply declare that any particular judge is no longer exhibiting good behavior in the president's judgment. Then the judge's term has simply come to an end, this official said. The elected and appointed Republican officials who made these dangerous statements are reflecting an even more broadly held belief system on the part of some grassroots extremist organizations that have made the destruction of judicial independence the centerpiece of their political agenda. Tony Perkins, head of the Family Research Council, said, "There's more than one way to skin a cat, and there's more than one way to take a black robe off the bench." Perkins has claimed that he's had meetings with Republican leaders during which they discussed openly stripping the funding from certain courts whose rulings they didn't like. What they're thinking of is not only the fact of just making these courts go away and recreating them the next day, but also defunding them, Perkins went on to say of the Republican leaders. Congress could use its appropriations authority, he said, to just take away the bench, all of his staff, and he's just sitting out there with nothing to do. Another influential right-wing spokesman, James Dobson, who heads the group Focus on the Family, focused his anger on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. He said, "Very few people know this, but the Congress can simply disenfranchise a court. They don't have to fire anybody or impeach them or go through that battle. All they have to do is say the Ninth Circuit doesn't exist anymore, and it's gone." Through such threats, many Republicans are creating an atmosphere in which judges might well hesitate to exercise their independence for fear of congressional retribution. These views are completely at odds with the spirit of the U.S. Constitution. There have been times in America's past when the independence of the courts has been threatened by political maneuvers, but over time, the appreciation for protecting the independence of the judicial branch has grown steadily. Alexander Hamilton warned, "The independence of judges is equally requisite to guard the Constitution and the rights of individuals from the effects of those ill humors which the arts of designing men or the influence of particular conjunctures sometimes disseminate among the people themselves, and which, though they speedily give place to better information and more deliberate reflection, have a tendency, in the meantime, to occasion dangerous innovations in the government and serious oppressions of the minor party in the community." Conservative pressure on the federal bench began in earnest in 1982, when a few conservative law students gathered at the Yale and University of Chicago law schools, nurtured by law professors such as Robert Bork and Antonin Scalia. They dubbed themselves the Federalist Society, a group largely populated by the ranks of young Reagan administration officials, set on nothing short of seeding the judiciary with jurists who, like themselves, believed in a view of individual rights and federal power that was a good deal narrower than the status quo. To this new society, the courts were mistakenly adapting the Constitution to the times rather than hewing close to the intent of its 18th-century drafters. Among the members of the group, future Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito. Funded by the John M. Olin Lind and Harry Bradley, Sarah Scaife and Charles G. Koch Foundation, the group was angered and energized 5 years into its existence when Congress rejected Judge Robert Bork's Supreme Court nomination. Federalist Society branches spread across all of the country's major law schools. Their first big victory was beating back the attack on Justice Clarence Thomas's nomination, and soon their members were dominating the Senate Judiciary Committee. Most recently, the Federalist Society has been credited with the rise of Justices Roberts and Alito. In the wake of the controversy surrounding the disgraced lobbyist Jack Abramoff and the all-expenses-paid lobbying trips for members of Congress, the new House of Representatives that took office in January 2007 has outlawed such congressional junkets, and the Senate is soon expected to do the same. But there has been startlingly little attention paid to similar corporate junkets for the federal judiciary. Special interest groups have started hosting education seminars for federal judges at expensive resorts to teach these judges their conservative ideologies. Often these groups spend thousands of dollars on entertainment, travel, and other hospitality expenses for every judge in attendance. Some of these gatherings are more genuinely balanced than others, and some appear to have a principal focus on a genuine philosophical exchange of ideas. But on more than a few occasions, the curriculum presented is heavily weighted toward right-wing ideology, leavened with a minimum representation of alternative views to maintain the ruse that it is not a heavily biased presentation. These groups argue that in the modern world of constantly changing technology, judges need to seek the most up-to-date information on a series of technical issues in order to make informed decisions. Of course, Congress created the nonpartisan Federal Judicial Center for the express purpose of providing the best information to judges on whatever issues they want to research. But some of these special interest groups are less interested in providing dispassionate postgraduate education for judges and are mainly interested instead in persuading judges to adopt their point of view. The watchdog group Community Rights Council, CRC, has conducted extensive research into which groups have been sponsoring these events, which judges have attended, and how their decisions have consistently supported the corporate groups that provide their education. The results of this research are unsurprising but alarming, given our founders' desire to create an independent judiciary. CRC has found that the number of educational trips for judges has increased substantially by over 60% between the mid-1990s and 2004. In some years, over 10% of federal judges have attended such events. While many of these seminars are actually intended to provide education and information, the percentage that are sponsored by the Big Three, the Foundation for Research on Economics and the Environment, George Mason University's Law and Economics Center, LEC, and the Liberty Fund, has also increased dramatically. These three organizations have an avowedly conservative approach to the law, and particularly toward environmental law and regulations. They stress that environmental laws should be repealed in favor of property protections for corporate polluters, and the judges they invite to attend their training seminars are predictable. In total, 68% of the attendees to Big Three conferences between 2002 and 2004 were Republican appointees, and at Liberty Fund events during the same period, 97% of attendees were Republican-appointed judges. CRC documented that those judges who return to these conferences multiple times are generally responsible for writing the most radical, pro-corporate, anti-environmental, and activist decisions. Of course, it would be impossible to prove that attending these conferences changes a judge's opinions, but CRC reports that an LEC newsletter proudly proclaims that many judges report that the program totally altered their frame of reference for cases involving economic issues. These groups are not providing unbiased judicial education. They are giving multi-$1,000 vacations to federal judges to promote their radical right-wing agenda at the expense of the public interest. Over time, this effort has had a pronounced effect. It is one more example of how wealth has replaced reason at the center of our representative democracy, this time in the heart of the judicial branch of government. Our founders understood that neither intelligence nor education provided insulation from the temptations and frailties that are inherent in human nature. Some argue that the remedy for this problem is simply to encourage environmental and other public interest groups to host their own education seminars for federal judges. But the classic problem facing advocates of a broad and diffuse public interest who rely mainly on the force of argument and the rule of reason is that they simply do not have access to the same supplies of concentrated wealth that are often available to advocates of narrow special interests whose continued income is vitally affected by the decisions of the courts, the Congress, and the executive branch. But even if they did have such resources, it would be just as wrong for advocates of particular outcomes in cases before the court to be sponsoring and designing educational programs for judges induced to attend them by offers of free vacations. If our founders believed that the judicial branch, described in Article 3 of the Constitution, was by far the weakest of the three branches, it is also true that they intended for the legislative branch, described in Article 1 of the Constitution, to be the strongest. Although some of them disagreed, the vast majority felt that the legislative branch would be the most important guarantee against the emergence of an abusive concentration of power in the executive. The most serious and most surprising failure of checks and balances in the last several years has been the abdication by Congress of its role as a co-equal branch of government. Following the elections of 2006, the new Democratic leadership of the Congress has begun an overdue effort to recoup the standing of the legislative branch. But serious damage was done by the obsequious majority that controlled the House during the previous 12 years and the Senate for most of that time, and especially from January 2001 until January 2007. In that span, the Republican leadership was so deferential to the president that they abandoned the practice of holding oversight hearings and allowed the executive branch to almost completely control the operations of the Congress. The need for constant fundraising to purchase television commercials makes the Congress highly vulnerable to the influence of special interest groups that specialize in providing campaign contributions. And in the Republican Party, the fundraising process has been nationalized in a way that gives an incumbent president of the same party enormous influence over who gets contributions in House and Senate races and who does not. It is the pitiful state of our legislative branch that primarily explains the failure of our vaunted system of checks and balances to prevent the dangerous overreach by our executive branch, which now threatens a radical transformation of the American system. I was elected to Congress in 1976 and served 8 years in the House and 8 years in the Senate, and I presided over the Senate for 8 years as vice president. As a young man, I saw the Congress firsthand as the son of a U.S. senator. My father was elected to Congress in 1938, 10 years before I was born, and left the Senate in 1971. The Congress we have today is unrecognizable compared with the one in which my father served. There are many distinguished senators and congressmen serving today. But the legislative branch of government under its former leadership operated as if it were entirely subservient to the executive branch. Moreover, too many members of the House and Senate now feel compelled to spend a majority of their time not in thoughtful debate of the issues, but raising money to purchase 30-second TV commercials. The executive branch, time and again, has co-opted Congress's role, and often Congress has been a willing accomplice in the surrender of its own power. Look, for example, at the congressional role in overseeing this massive 4-year eavesdropping campaign that on its face seemed so clearly to violate the Bill of Rights. The president says he informed Congress, but what he really means is that he talked with the chairman and ranking member of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees and the top leaders of the House and Senate. The members of this small group, in turn, claimed that they were not given the full facts, though at least one of the Intelligence Committee leaders hand-wrote a letter of concern to Vice President Cheney and placed a copy in his own safe. In any event, these leaders were briefed in secret and could not divulge the contents of their briefings to other members or even to their own staffs. That is why the note to Vice President Cheney had to be handwritten. Thus, the briefings could not have led to congressional deliberation over the wisdom of the surveillance program and trade-offs it made between liberty and security. Though I sympathize with the awkward position in which these men and women were placed, I cannot disagree with the Liberty Coalition when it said that Democrats, as well as Republicans in the Congress, must share the blame for not taking action to protest and seek to prevent what they consider a grossly unconstitutional program. There are many members of Congress now serving who have never had the experience of actually conducting an oversight hearing. In the 1970s and 1980s, the oversight hearings in which my colleagues and I participated held the feet of the executive branch to the fire, no matter which party was in power. During my first 2 terms in the House of Representatives, for example, I joined with my Democratic colleagues in holding hard-hitting and often adversarial oversight hearings on the conduct of the executive branch of Democratic President Jimmy Carter, not because of any lack of respect for him, but simply because we felt that was part of our job as members of the legislative branch of government. Yet, oversight virtually disappeared during the first 6 years of the Bush-Cheney administration because the party loyalty of the Republican congressional leaders outweighed their respect for the independent role that the legislative branch is supposed to play in our constitutional system. The role of authorization committees has declined for decades, at times into insignificance. Many annual appropriation bills never actually pass. Everything is lumped into a single giant measure that is not even available for members of Congress to read before they vote on it. More recently, members of the Democratic Party were routinely excluded from conference committees, and amendments were routinely not allowed during floor consideration of legislation. In the United States Senate, which used to pride itself on being the greatest deliberative body in the world, meaningful debate was a rarity. The Republican leaders of the House and Senate even started blocking Democrats from attending conference committee meetings where legislation takes its final form. Instead, they let the president's staff come to the meetings to write key parts of the laws for them. Moreover, the ability of voters to hold members of Congress responsible for this abdication of their responsibility has been too often muted by the increasingly pro forma nature of most congressional re-election campaigns. The drawing of district lines to favor incumbents of both parties, the large taxpayer-funded budgets for computerized mass mailings, newsletters, video press releases, and airplane travel back and forth every weekend to their districts, and the ability to raise large sums of money to buy television advertising are all factors that combine to ensure that the vast majority of incumbents are re-elected no matter what. In the House of Representatives, the number who face a genuinely competitive election contest every 2 years is typically less than 15%, and the number of seats that actually change hands every 2 years is very small. Every so often, there is a larger shift in the public mood, as there was in 1994 and in 2006, when control of the Congress changes from one party to the other. And too many incumbents have come to believe that the key to continued access to the money for re-election is to stay on the good side of those who have the money to give. And, in the case of the Republican Party, the whole process is controlled largely by the incumbent president and his political organization. More and more, general elections are turning into a formality, especially in the U.S. House of Representatives. The framers of the Constitution had in mind specific roles for the two chambers of Congress. The House contained the unruly youngsters, reactive to the passions of the day, thanks in part to an imposition of 2-year terms. Senators, on the other hand, would hold office for 6-year terms and serve to check the House with a deliberativeness that longevity in office afforded. Until recently, it followed that House seats turned over more frequently than Senate seats. In recent years, that juxtaposition has flipped. In the 4 elections of the new millennium, House members have been